www.sproutsradio.org. Check us out next week on Sprouts. Thanks for listening.
On Free Radio, it's Bathrop's Beers Broadsides. Stay with us for the next 2 hours for the August 3rd show. Going to be featuring discussions of Hiroshima Day, which is coming up, as well as the Seaside Company's latest land grab and more. Stay tuned.
Sound of injustice is drowned out by the boom boom. found yourself at the corner of 27th and Santa Clara at a McDonald's parking lot, surrounded by four police cruisers, while two pigs in SWAT gear search your car illegally, and a third one frisks you. And now I'm not talking about no pussy little frisk like you see in front of a club. I'm talking about a real motherfucking frisk like they do on cops when they tell you to spread your legs, put your hands on the hood of the car, and they pat you down so good you think you're getting a hand job. And you know, if they don't find nothing on you, if they don't find nothing on you, oh shit, look out downtown, but somewhere someone's getting arrested for being brown in downtown. Someone's getting beat to a pulp by Billy Clubs in a back alley for being brown in downtown. Someone's getting shot for being brown in downtown. And everywhere, 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 that's us going down for being brown in downtown.
And that was Trece Cholos from Grito Serpentino. Me opening theme, it's the fourth today, not the third, in case you were wondering why I'm a day behind. I'm not sure, but that happens every so often. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrop Spears, Broadsides, Civil Rights in Santa Cruz, and other spots, and wherever we can find them. We talk about them, and we can't find them. We try to create them. That's the idea around the show, particularly local stuff. So you'll hear me taken out after censorship wherever it happens. You'll hear me taken out after what I feel to be unfair treatment, even if that if such a thing as such a place as such a good, cool scene as Free Radio. And that's happened before. And that's what I do. So it's also an opportunity for you to express your thoughts and feelings. You can do that by calling in. 427-3772 is the call-in line, 831-427-3772. And you can also jump on the chat room, pagesincolor.com, all one word, all small letters, pagesincolor.com, and I will answer all your questions, or perhaps none of your questions if I don't know the answers, but I'll certainly look at them and we can talk about it. So, hoping today to talk about a number of topics. One of them, of course, is Hiroshima Day. We're coming up on the 60th anniversary of the American nuclear bombing of the civilian city of Hiroshima in Japan. Grim topic for me, and one that always makes me shake my head. Of course, I didn't lose anybody in that particular bombing, and there's always been controversy around it because even my father, for instance, who fought in World War II, talks about how it was at least conceived by the soldiers as being a necessary action to end the Second World War. My understanding is considerably different. I'm going to read a couple of opinion pieces on that subject, which may not be unfamiliar to those who've studied the subject, but I think are worth looking over. We're going to be talking about that if anybody wants to talk about it. I'm really interested in the angle here is Hiroshima and the homeless. Of course, Hiroshima, of course, created, what is it, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of homeless Japanese civilians. It essentially blew up a city of 100,000 people. And, of course, there were more destructive raids on Tokyo and on Dresden that killed more people and made more people homeless. But this was, of course, the most singly destructive raid of the Second World War, I guess, that and the expedition 3 days later against Nagasaki. Anyway, I'll be talking about that in a bit. I'm also going to be hoping to begin talking in about 20 minutes about the Seaside Company's land grab around the Tidelands, which we've talked about a little bit on this show. And I'm hoping to get some call-ins from the grand old man of the fight back against the Seaside Company movement, as I call it, Phil Baer. Phil is, however, kind of hard to reach, and I'm not sure if I'm going to reach him, but who knows, maybe somebody else who's been challenging this issue will be around, and I'll begin talking about this more in earnest in about 15 minutes. Right now, I'm going to go to the HUF meeting of yesterday. HUF is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom group I work with, and you can find out more about what we're about, which is civil rights for poor people, by going on the net at huffsantacruz.org, all small letters, huffsantacruz.org, all one word. And most of that stuff is dated, but unfortunately, a lot of it's still true about the way homeless people are treated and mistreated in Santa Cruz, the kind of unconstitutional, illegal, legal structure we have that criminalizes a whole bunch of people simply because of their economic status and treats them pretty badly. And it's a subject that won't go away, and I also apparently don't want to go away on that subject either, so I continue to bring it up. Recently wrote a letter on this subject for HUF. Actually, Becky Johnson and I both did. Becky is both my producer, and she's also an activist with Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom and a writer for Street Spirit. And we and others in HUF have been challenging for many years the set of laws put in place by so-called liberals like Mike Rodkin and Scott Kennedy, and supported by people like Tony Madrigal, who should know better and claims to, which criminalize just whole areas of human behavior. We're talking, of course, here about the sleeping ban. And if you want to go to Indie Media, you can check this out. That's santacruzindiemedia.org, www.santacruz.indiemedia.org. And you can find the letter that HUF recently sent to Judge Kathleen Acow. And this has to do with a sort of a standard run-of-the-mill case. Sharon Pate is a woman who lives in her vehicle. I think we've actually interviewed her on Free Radio along with, well, hundreds of other homeless people over the years. And she was up at the 24-hour fitness parking lot, of which she is a member. And she was caught nodding off under the influence of sleep rather than any other drug in her vehicle at where she was legally parked, entitled to be. And she was given a citation, and she unsuccessfully fought it in court and got a bad sentence, a sentence of 15 hours of community service when the maximum prescribed is 8. And so we've written Judge Acow asking her to change that to 8 hours. Actually, we suggested she drop the whole thing because there's no shelter for people like Sharon in the summer when there's about 40 to 45 space for 40 to 45 people out of a population of 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people. In the winter, it's about 160, space for 160 out of 1,500 to 2,000. So it's ludicrous to suggest that there's anything near adequate shelter space, and it's obviously completely inappropriate to criminalize people for doing what they have to do each night, sleep. And this goes on every night. This goes on every night of the year, 365 nights of the year. It doesn't happen to all 1,500 to 2,000. It happens to very few of them directly. But the threat of it hangs over them like a dark cloud, and it puts people in a position where they can't sleep safely in groups, they can't sleep safely in well-lighted areas, they can't use police services. And then, of course, as people who are struggling to survive, they have to deal with the kind of bogus camping citations that people like Sharon get for simply engaging in the crime of providing their own affordable housing, a vehicle. So we're waiting to hear back from Kathleen Acow. I'll be posting whatever response I get from her, and I'm not frankly expecting much. We're working on a number of things at HUF around this issue of the sleeping ban. There was a decision some years ago in the California Supreme Court called the ICORN decision, E-I-C-H-O-R-N, ICORN, which ruled that anybody who is accused of a crime of camping or sleeping has the right, not just a judicial option. Usually judges can say, well, you might be able to have this or you might not. I'll make a decision. But in this case, the court ruled that in every single case, people accused of camping, if it's being used as a criminal statute, have the right to the so-called necessity defense, which means the right to say, I had to do it because I had no other choice. All other choices would have subjected to me to a graver dangers and evils that I needed to avoid. You know, such things as physical harm, the kind of injury that comes from having no sleep at night, because what this law envisages is that you stay awake every minute of every hour between 11 and 8:30 in the morning, between 11 at night and 8:30 in the morning, and it's ridiculous. But if you want to hear Mayor Mike Rotkin explain it to you and explain to you why it's necessary, why it's gentle and humane and kind and something that is completely natural and that we have to do because we're living in a capitalist America and a capitalist Santa Cruz, even though he's a socialist feminist, you can give a call to Mayor Mike and his phone number, and this is a 24-hour number. You won't be disturbing him at home and waking him up in his sleep. But you can call him at 420-5023. That's his city council 24-hour number. And he will schedule an appointment with you to rattle on and tell you exactly how this is a adequate and perfectly decent solution and very progressive and much better than Carmel. And we're not beating up the homeless. We're just giving them the citations and moving them along. That's his answer. So, and we're not doing it to many of them, just a few, and only problem cases, and only if there's a complaint, and only after warning. These last three things, of course, are not true, but when you ask him for documentation, he just says, well, I know it's true because of my information from the police department. But, of course, that information is not public information. It's not documented information. It doesn't square with the information I get when I interview people for the show. Hence, I have to tell you that Mike is full of shit on this issue. He's simply wrong. And it has to be put rather harshly because this hurts a lot of people every night. And for someone who is purportedly progressive, and that's not, doesn't just go for Rotkin, it goes for every single member of the Santa Cruz City Council, who doesn't stand up and say this law needs to be changed and changed immediately. In fact, restitution should really be provided to people who have been arrested under this law. Anyway, Huff is looking for solutions to this. In the meantime, we're trying to advise the judges of the fact, in case they haven't been aware of it already, that there is no shelter space. And so to claim that people should have shelter and should go to shelter and can somehow seek some legal kind of shelter in Santa Cruz under pain of getting a ticket for not seeking shelter and sleeping instead is simply false. It's a false dilemma that is created because there is no shelter for people in Santa Cruz other than the 40 lucky lottery winners. Actually, they're not lottery winners. They're usually severely disabled elderly people who have regular spots on the so-called Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program. Anybody who disputes these facts, welcome to call Community Action Board shelter provider Paul Brindell, who has been, he's no buddy of mine, but he certainly has been studying this problem for a long time and getting well paid for it. He's on the Community Action Board's shelter project, and his phone number is 457-1741. And it's also under Community Action Board. Or you can call Ken Cole, the Homeless Services Center, and talk to him. Ken Cole is, since 1999, has been head of the Homeless Services Center, executive director. He was vice chair of the Homeless Issues Task Force. His number is 458-6020. So you might have trouble getting either of these guys to call you back. Sometimes they do, and often they don't. But they can testify to you that, no, there is no shelter space for people. And in fact, the shelter itself puts out a little mimeograph sheet that they give people to take to court to bring to the judges to say, there was no shelter that night, Your Honor. Can you please dismiss the ticket? So, that's some of what's going on around this. And if you're interested in being a part of a process of changing unjust laws, you can come to Huff meetings. We meet every Wednesday, 8:30 in the morning, at the so-called American Cafe, which is in the basement of the county building next to the courthouse, which is at Ocean and Water Streets, 701 Ocean, basement of the county building in the cafeteria / American Cafe. Or you can check out the Human Rights Organization. It's another group that meets. They meet every Saturday, 1:45, out at the Homeless Services Center's dining bay at 115 Coral Street. And a lot of this information, in case it's coming at you too fast for you to pick up on, just remember the number 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF. If you dial that phone number, you'll get a somewhat creaky message from April, recorded in April, but that is still generally accurate, which kind of repeats most of the information that I've just given you. And you can always leave a message there, and I'll get back to you. If you want to be on this show, if you have some information around homeless civil rights issues that you think should go out to the community, police misconduct, problems with merchants, Or if you've got problems, you know, as a resident. We've had residents who've called them and said, we're having problems with particular homeless people. What should we do? We want to be compassionate and fair, but we don't want to be subjected to abuse ourselves. And these are reasonable concerns as well. You can leave a message at 423-HUFF, and I can get back to you if you want to talk about this stuff on the air. Of course, you can call in now. Phone number is 427-3772. And just to show you that it isn't always me talking, here's a guy called Hot Rod who comes to homeless meetings. He's homeless himself, and he talks quite eloquently about being homeless.
Well, it's about 11:05. We're at the American Cafe on Wednesday, the 3rd of August, at a HUFF meeting, listening to Hot Rod. Hot Rod, what's been happening?
It's a disaster, especially the spider bites. The infection goes right to down to the bone, and I can't...
I'm looking at your hands. Your thumb is wrapped up in bandages, and wow, there's some nasty-looking welts and sores on your both hands.
Yeah, I got to make it to Emmeline as fast as I can, even to wash with Betadine. And
what happened this morning?
I was at the Red Church on the asphalt. I thought they would be... where I could survive for the night. It was freezing cold. I'm fortunate I had one blanket. And it's just a day after day experience, and everybody's hanging by whatever they can do with the Social Security money or how. And I don't drink and smoke and carouse. It's just the fact that I need a spot to where if I pay Section 8, that's like a third of my check, which is too... I can't do it. All my legal stuff I'm getting... And fortunately, the London... the policeman, his name's Willie. He's a bald-headed...
Willie Brandt.
Yeah.
Officer Brandt!
He gives me the riot act and tells me about his taxes, got to get rid of people like us.
And when did he have this conversation with him?
Every time I get involved with him.
The last time you spoke with him?
This morning... But he was pretty easy on me, lenient, because he doesn't give me tickets. Fortunately, he's
fair. Speeches and...
He gives me what they call,
uplifting commentary.
His heart rendering, and he's a decent, seemed-to-be guy.
Ball-busting kind of analysis.
Yeah, and he means well, but there's no solution other than to give me...
When did he... You were sleeping overnight at the Red Church.
To get out of the city. Or to the state. That's what.
Hold it. Red Church is in the city, and you were sleeping overnight. How many baskets of merchandise and stuff did you have?
Three bicycles, three older bicycles, and about six backpacks and one sleeping bag, and that's it.
You were traveling light.
I'm always traveling light. My problem is we got to get sociably acceptable where it's... A house or housing of some sort.
So you did or didn't get a ticket today?
No, I was fortunate. But I did. I have been acquiring tickets.
When's the last time you got a ticket, Hot Rod?
Over by the dumpster at the end of the park, right here, I had two camp tickets, one for setting up a permanent camp, which was nonsense. There's rats and raccoons. You can't hide. You can't
get this ticket.
Just about last Friday. Yeah.
Who gave it to you?
A lady police. They spotted me down there. And you know, it's a Gestapo tactic. And
what time of day did you get it?
It was in the afternoon. I couldn't.
Did you have a tent set up? Did you have a fire set up?
From the no, nothing. I just had my.
Were you surrounded by 16 shopping carts?
No, I only had one wagon, a little child's thing, and I had a bicycle cart that I had to pull around by hand.
What did this police officer, this wasn't Officer Bechtel, was it?
It was a lady officer and a sergeant. And they always,
was she in light blue or dark blue?
Oh, dark blue.
So it wasn't Officer Bechtel.
I never see him in light blue, always in dark. And
she gave you a citation for setting up a campsite?
What
kind of day was it?
About 2 or 3. It was very hot, and I can't take the heat.
Did she ask you if you were intending to spend the night?
He said, you're in a city park.
Did she ask you if you were intending to spend the night?
No, I don't believe
because,
so.
You see, in order to...
I had to. I was crippled.
However, in order for them to prove that you are guilty of...
camping under that section, which is setting up a campsite. They have to prove you have the intention to stay overnight. So for all of you Free Radio Santa Cruz listeners out there, don't tell the police you intend to stay overnight. Make them prove it in court if, in fact, they want to harass you in that way. Just a quick aside. Go ahead, Otto.
And just an aside to the aside. I'm talking about the camping section of the camping ordinance rather than the sleeping section. The sleeping section and the blanket section, which make it criminal to sleep at night or to cover up with a blanket at night, are in effect only between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. But the camping section is in effect 24 hours a day and has to do with the intention of setting up a campsite overnight. So if the officer wishes to ticket you or harass you during the day, that is the section he will use, the third section, and that requires him to prove intention to stay overnight. Judges, of course, give police a lot of leeway in this, and few of these tickets actually go to trial because most people have enough trouble finding shelter, food, toilets, and so forth, not to have to worry about struggling into court, although some of them do get to court because of failures to appear turn into warrants, and warrants turn into pickups by police, which get you into jail, and which eventually end you up in those fashionable orange pajamas, or the purple pajamas if you're a woman, in the dock of court in the morning, in custody.
Well, it's miserable, and I'm losing a lot of my strength, and I guess can't make it.
What other citations have you gotten recently?
I had an open container. I hardly ever drink, and it's very seldom. And this, the same like lady, they're all kind of similar. Came up in on her bicycle, and we're right by that smelly dumpster area that I had to hurry to get out of, and because there was flies and maggots, and it's disgusting. So she came in right there, and took. And I really wasn't drinking a beer. It was more like I forgot what they bought me. But anyway, she said, I want that, and it was between my legs, and I just took it and drank it, what was very left, and she twisted it on my, and cut my lip. As you can see my lip, okay, and I'm not making this up. She pulled a can and she twisted it and cut my, fucked up my lip, and right away dumped it.
When was it?
Huh?
When?
Oh, about last Saturday. Yeah, early in the morning when it was cold, and that was my breakfast. It was all
about Saturday, about 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, the other two guys were helping me. I hired them. I bought them some food, and we just, I needed protection because there's a lot of idiots out there that want to just take my bags, and that's my medicine and my belongings, my clothes.
Now you're disabled yourself?
I'm very disabled. I'm getting worse as it goes.
What is the nature of your disability?
I got diabetes and high blood pressure and...
How old are you?
All kinds of I'm very delicate.
How old are you?
I'm 53. And
good looking as well.
Nine months. Don't forget those 9 months.
All right. Hodrod, anything more before we cut you off at the pass?
Yeah, from womb to the tomb till death do us part. God bless us all. And whoever doesn't believe in that, I'm all for it because I'm looking forward to those pearly gates and golden streets.
So assisted suicide could be the answer. We won't get into that.
No suicide?
No suicide. I just need energy.
At a gathering called Music in the Park?
Yeah. And I played a tambourine or banged the drums or, you know, it's called jamming. You jam. And here we are. We're right now. We're jamming. And it's called liberty.
Babble, babble.
And the pursuit of happiness and property. And we got to keep on jamming. In all the races, it's a non-racial. It's the war on poverty is the big problem because they don't allow survival.
You mean the war on the poor?
Well, whatever.
There's no war on poverty. There's a war on the poor.
Just told me you're better off in Germany, in Cologne, or a lot of places, Heidelberg. But and so the main thing I can't talk fast enough because I'm desperate, and I'm trying mainly to commune with. Community,
and we hope you continue in that.
I gave Hot Rod the quick hook. He's very eloquent, but I get impatient That was in a conversation I had yesterday with him. He's continuing to fight a number of tickets, as you've heard. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, and shortly I'm going to be on the line trying to talk to, actually I think successfully, about to talk to Phil and possibly Jane Baer, issues around the Seaside Company. What's that about? Well, if you look at the current issue of the Metro News, N-U-Z, it's a one-page news and views column on page 7. I think it's written by Sarah Phelan, at least it used to be, who's now the editor of the Santa Cruz Metro. She's actually talking about local issues that are less fluffy than usual, although she is weighing in with the usual fluff on Lisa Molyneux, the operator of Greenway, first ever cannabis club person in the last 5 years to get past the city council barricades and get a permit. And she's been working on that. I talked to Lisa earlier today, and she'll be probably calling in maybe on Sunday, if I can manage that. Not much is happening yet. She's filing her plans with the planning department. She's already filed the diagrams. Now she has to file the operating plan, I believe. Anyway, in news is talking about the Seaside Company. I'll be kind of going over and castigating Sarah for her usual puff job on the medical marijuana situation, but let's put that aside for the moment. Here's what she says about the Santa Cruz Seaside Company. The Santa Cruz Seaside Company, it seems, is no longer happy with its so-called quiet title to the portion of former Tidelands estuary at the mouth of the San Lorenzo River, which it has used as a six-acre parking lot since 1962. Now, in order to settle the matter once and for all, the Seaside Company will sue the world. On July 6, 2005, Seaside Company filed a lawsuit against the City of Santa Cruz, the State Lands Commission, and, well, everyone else that might assert a cloud upon plaintiff's title. That is, this is what it comes to, suing cloud makers. Or as the lawsuit puts it, they're suing all persons unknown claiming any legal or equitable right, title, estate, lien, or interest in the property described in the complaint adverse to plaintiff's title are sued herein pursuant to Code of Civil Procedure, Section 762060. The clouds themselves were unavailable for comment, but judging by the demeanor of the fog that rolled in off the bay last week, heavy and lethargic, they're not happy, and neither are some staunch environmentalists. Back in 1998, then council members Keith Sugar, Christopher Crone, Tim Fitzmaurice, and Catherine Byers hired hotshot environmental attorney Antonio Rossman of Mono Lake fame to help them reclaim the land. Rossman's report has never been released to the public, and all was quiet for years, until now. Kind of. City Attorney John Barasoni says the Seaside Company advised the city in December 2004 that it expected to file a complaint in January 2005. Earlier this year, the city asked State Senator Joe Simishian to author S-960, a bill that would have laid the legal foundation for a land exchange. The bill made it through its first committee, after which the city asked Simishian to pull it out. Barasoni explains that there were some other developments up at the State Lands Commission that led them to believe the bill wouldn't fully resolve the matter. Bill Morrison, spokesman for the State Lands Commission, says that while they hope to avoid litigation, the legislation wouldn't prevent anyone from filing suit. In other words, they were looking for a way to stop the Seaside Company from a lawsuit. I had thought myself 6 years ago or 7 years ago that we were going to sue, we the people, under the great new liberals, Sugar, progressives, Crone, Sugar, and Fitzmaurice and Byers, to actually get back the land that the Seaside Company took away and turned into a parking lot, maybe even more land. Phil Baer, who I'm going to be having on the air shortly, if I can get this phone operational, and I think I probably can, himself became famous around the same time for successfully, I guess he filed his own lawsuit against the Seaside Company, or at least exposed some important facts. And let's see if we can get old Phil on the air to talk about this issue here. Hello, Phil Baer. Hang on here. So, Phil, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I hope we're not blasting everyone away here. Phil, have you heard some of what I've been saying? I hope you turned down your radio because now it's going to be confusing you.
Oh, yes, I see you got a little delay thing.
We do have a delay, so if you say the word fuck, we're not going to let you be on the air. Keep that in mind.
Okay.
So keep your fucking language clean, okay?
All right.
All right, then.
That's reserved for you, right?
That, well, you can actually, this is free radio, at least free in some respects, and you can say that if you wish.
Okay.
But we hope you'll be very respectful to your Seaside Company masters down there.
Right.
So I've just been reading this article in the Santa Cruz Metro. Have you read it?
Yes.
I've read the first part of it. I haven't read the part of it that talks about The city has until August 5th to respond to the Seaside Company's complaint. And the kind of the, I guess, the ring around the rosy that happened when you, Patricia Matichek, I guess Aldo Giacchino, Fred Geiger, and others tried to meet at the city council's closed-door meeting and couldn't get in?
Right.
Well, first of all, what happened there?
Well, Ed Porter had put the thing on the agenda, but apparently it was a late request, so it didn't get on the printed agenda. But everybody knew about it, as I understand it, and someone, whoever handles that, had written it in on the agenda as is posted there outside the council chambers and elsewhere.
Now, this is the closed city council meeting, which is kind of the rare. I've been to two or three of these closed meetings. They don't. They usually held what in the, kind of in the back room behind the city council.
Precisely.
And you can't. You can get to the what you used to be able not to go to these meetings at all. But I believe actually I was one of the people who forced this issue about.
I believe you were.
4 years ago, when they
were suing
three of us for a peaceful lobbying effort at the city council offices under the reign of. Mayor Fitzmaurice, and we went to talk about it at the closed session, I believe, and they realized that under the Brown Act, they had to open up the beginning of the session to provide for public comment, at which point they kicked us all out and did the real talking.
Yes.
So what happened with what, first of all, who showed up at this session, and what were you there for?
Well, as you say, the complaint by the Seaside Company was filed on July 5th, giving the defendants 30 days to respond. That would have been August 5th. And we kept asking various people whether or not the city had responded, and they were vague on that point amongst all others. And finally, we decided that we had to kind of intrude ourselves into the matter at that point, because our fear was that they had not responded to the complaint, and that Tuesday meeting last Tuesday was the last formal council meeting before August recess, so our speculation was that the plan was to stall on the matter, go on the recess, then Seaside comes in the next day and serves them with the complaint, and they have 30 days to respond, except that their next scheduled meeting would have been more than 30 days away, something in early September.
Now, in layman's language, I've read Sarah, who I assume to be, presumed to be Sarah Phelan.
I don't
believe
it was Sarah's, actually. She had a young man who is
covering
sort of her street reporter now.
Huh, okay. Well, whoever
actually, Sarah understands the issue better than the fellow who wrote it and would have done a better job with it.
Huh.
Not that I was...
Well, explain to us exactly... I mean, clarify for us exactly why this is an important lawsuit for every Jane, you know, John and Sarah out there. I mean, what...
Okay, yes, I'll start at the beginning and run through the basic underlying legalities of it. Water is a public resource. Ever since Justinian law in Roman times, practically every nation on the face of the earth has reserved water, specifically navigable waterways and submerged waters, that is to say tidal waters, waters that are submerged on a daily basis by the high tide line. All such waters are reserved for the public and are forbidden to be sold or otherwise possessed by private individuals or corporations. That's the part of the public trust, public domain.
And that's true in California as well?
It's true everywhere. It was true in England, and England gave that right to the 13 colonies back when they were 13 colonies. And when the nation formed, the nation immediately assumed those rights and granted the tidelands to each of these states. The tidelands within the state becomes the possession of the state to be held in trust for the public. And after the 13 colonies, all of the new states, as they joined the Union, became owners of tidelands within their new state under an equal footing clause in the Constitution.
After eliminating, of course, all pesky Native Americans who might have been fishing in those areas.
That could be.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
State of California gained ownership of all tidelands within the state of California upon admission to the Union, September 9th, 1850.
Then came the Seaside Company.
Sometime after, actually. Seaside Company goes back to old Fred Swanton and is sort of at the earliest, late 19th century. But through various dealings, Fred Swanton, a judgment, a decree that he achieved in 1933 that I think is referenced in the newspaper article and is sort of the linchpin of the Seaside claim to these properties. Fred Swanton maneuvered that when he was both president of the boardwalk and mayor of the city,
mm-hmm.
if you detect that.
Well, did he get free rides on the roller coaster? I guess he put the city on the roller coaster. Huh?
Oh, it was really, it's quite a bizarre little legal document, that judgment and decree of 1933. Absolutely meaningless for various ways.
What it did was it gave the tidelands to the Seaside Company to use for its own private profit instead of allowing it for the citizens of Santa Cruz, right?
There were three parties to it, actually. Seaside Company was the plaintiff. The defendants were the city of Santa Cruz and various private individuals who had owned property in the area and apparently had since moved on. All of those private individuals failed to respond to the summons, so were found in default. The city of Santa Cruz initially responded with a demurrer that contested the proceedings on the basis that there was a misjoinder of parties, in that what they considered to be and what we consider to be the rightful owner of much of the land, the state, was not named as a defendant in the action, and therefore the action was meaningless.
The state of California, in other words.
The state of California.
So it wasn't the city of Santa Cruz that really considered to own the land. And we're talking about the land between the high tide mark and the low tide mark. Is that the land we're talking about?
The defining quality is land that was below the historic mean high tide line, meaning where the average high tide line was when California became a state.
Well,
that line is fixed.
And for those,
if something happens after that point, as it did here, with a whole bunch of fill and levees and other crap that shoves the land into the former historic tidelands and shoves the water back, nonetheless, the line that defines tidelands for legal purposes is the line that a judge determines to have been this average high tide line as it existed before this artificial stuff.
When did that be
the point of California becoming a state in 1850?
Phil, when did that landfill stuff begin? Do you have any historical
Very
sense of
early
that?
On. There's a bulwark that was put over along Lower 3rd Street that goes way on back, that kind of shoved that section out. And then that would have been something like 1850 even.
And was it recognized at that time that that property was still owned by the state of California or the city of Santa Cruz in spite of its suddenly being dry land instead of being tideland?
No, the tideland law has never really been applied here at all. Various things have happened. The Southern Pacific Railroad came in 1892 and dumped a lot of fill and basically put the railroad on what previously had been a submerged tide land area that is now the main beach. It looks pretty substantial now, but it in fact is all fill, and it too would be subject to a challenge.
Are you planning a lawsuit against Southern Pacific, Phil?
Well, they are involved in this to some degree because the Seaside Company traces part of their private title to a grant to them from Southern Pacific. The grant went from the federal government to Southern Pacific in 1892, and then somehow, at least that's what they claim, I haven't seen it, but they claim that Southern Pacific then sold or gave or whatever some of the land to them. So that's a chain of title that they claim to exist, which may or may not exist. It wasn't presented as exhibits in the complaint, and I'm real skeptical about pieces of it.
Let me see if I understand, though, what the actual land is we're talking about, because I know that in 1998, you yourself, you raised some legal issues that essentially, did they not block the Seaside Company from, or perhaps the City Council, from taking action that would, in essence, have given away public land to a private company?
I would like to think so. That was about when they had the beach area south of Laurel plan, and there was a plan for a 4.5-acre expansion of the amusement park up the river on what... most of which, at least, is, will be found to be tideland if anybody ever gets to the point of actually looking at the maps to try to determine what, in fact, is tideland. And we raised the issue at that point, and shortly thereafter, we have a title report on the property that... the Seaside Company's title report on the property that starts off right off the top with these strongly worded exemptions from coverage for challenges to title based on tidal and submerged issues. So our perception is that we really stirred things up not only with the city and the state, but with their own title company.
So what happened back then in 98, it was at the Rotkin Matthews Council at that time, and there was a solid majority to kind of hand everything over to the Seaside Company being fought by Catherine Byers and Celia Scott, right?
Yes.
And then you moved in with what exactly did you do that, shall we say, altered the situation? What information did you bring to light that caused things to change here?
Well, there were a number of factors that were occurring simultaneously. You'll recall there was a very vigorous public response to the beach area south of Laurel plan. In particular, I think they planned to expand the boardwalk, and there were probably 1,000 people down at a couple of those convention center gatherings. There was a strong objection to that plan. So I can't really take credit for stopping that plan, and in fact, we didn't stop all components of it. They just kind of shelved certain things and busted up the thing.
This was kind of Rotkin 1, where the beach south of Laurel was pushed and it got blocked, and then it, just as we had recently, the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel was recently blocked, sort of a similar, well, I guess it was more environmental concerns and neighborhood concerns, and with Rotkin on the other side pushing
right
for the development.
Rotkin assures me now, and you may have read him quoted to that effect in a Sentinel article a month or so ago, that he, or did he say the city? I don't know. I think he personalized it, that he and the city were going to vigorously defend against the lawsuit. So he has at least changed his public position on the matter.
That's the lawsuit that the Seaside Company is filing to try to, what, to secure for sure its parking lot that it's been charging money for
yes, but
for
the
six
kicker
decades.
On it is that also included in the complaint is their attempt to quiet title not merely on the parking lot, But on virtually their entire operation there along Beach Street, the entire boardwalk from practically the wharf all the way down to the river end, is also, they're seeking clear title on it, too.
Now, they don't have clear title now?
That would be my presumption, or they somehow feel... We occasionally mumbled amongst ourselves that too was subject to this kind of a challenge.
So the beach boardwalk
didn't work up the chutzpah to actually go for it.
The beach boardwalk itself, you're saying, much of it is on public land that should be a public resource and not one that can be exploited simply by Canfield and the Seaside Company.
No, under the public Thailand's laws, the state should be the owner. The state then grants it to the city as a grantee in trust, and the city is allowed to do what it wants to with the land within certain parameters.
But the land hasn't been turned over to the Seaside Company, even in that 1934 deal with mayor / boardwalk owner Fred Swanton?
There was a judgment and decree where a local judge, Superior Court judge, said basically that parties A, B, and C have been summoned on this matter. Party C, all these private individuals, failed to show, so they're out of it. Parties A and B came to an agreement where Seaside got certain land, the city got certain land. They both then signed what's called a waiver of conclusion. A waiver of legal findings.
But skipping the technicalities.
No, this is very crucial.
Oh, okay.
In terms of the legal weight that lawsuit, that judgment in 33 has. It's not like the judge looked at the matter, looked at the law, and then made a judicial determination based on the legal merits of the case.
He just found that they had a consensual agreement.
Exactly.
I
and
see.
He sort of ratified that consensual agreement.
So the issue of who actually has the real title to it based on the law has not been resolved.
It never even approached.
And Seaside...
That's why this is so exciting.
So Seaside...
It's the first time when hopefully that issue with all the relevant parties, including the actual, in our opinion at least, the actual owner of the land, the state... whether they wanted to get involved in this matter or not, they have now been dragged into this thing as a defendant, and our hope is that they will be too concerned about maintaining the integrity of the public trust doctrine itself to allow a negative conclusion to this case, which would function as a precedent that weakened their legal basis as protectors of the state Thailand. So we're hoping the state, if not the city, at least the state will get in there and raise the relevant issues.
Which it hasn't done so far.
It hasn't done because the state grants to the city Thailands within the city. That happened in 1872. So this is somewhat complicated. The state is the owner, but the city is the grantee in trust in what's called a non-proprietary capacity without the ability to sell, grant, or otherwise dispose of. But when the city allowed itself to sign on to this thing in 33 without the state being involved, it created this peculiar situation where the state didn't want to go for it singularly on its own. The state said right from the get-go that the city is the party here that should initiate the action, in which case the state would join them as co-plaintiffs in the action and provide at least half the legal expenses and legal know-how.
But
they wanted the city, because the land had been granted
right,
to the city, to
right.
initiate the action.
But up to now, the city has not... Let me just sort of so what happened at this last closed council meeting that you guys rushed over to, concerned about this issue. I know you yourself live in the Beach Flats area, and have for what, decades?
Or, yes.
You've seen the Seaside Company kind of eating up property and
yes.
And I guess you've been quite critical of some of the developments the Seaside Company has been involved with in the past.
Yes. not exactly how we came at it. We came at it mostly from a response to this flagrant heroin dealing on the streets down here, like it occurs not half so blatantly nowhere else in town.
Was Canfield, in fact, a major heroin dealer? Is that the...
Just kidding.
Well, unless you know something I don't know, I could not make that allegation
myself. Cotton candy,
but I
would
very
say.
Well, he has the wherewithal to stop it dead in a day if he wanted to.
He's a proven cotton candy dealer. I know that.
Yes.
So, I
mean,
but you know, here, what's interesting to me is so the current controversy in the metro, and in fact, the going on generally here is that the Seaside Company is trying an end run to get a quick decision that will, in essence, turn over everything to it, including the Tidelands, which I had thought that 6 or 7 years ago the city council was going to undertake a legal initiative to get that property back for the city as a, dare I say it, because Rotkin is so excited about it, because city manager Dick Wilson constantly rants about it, revenue source. You know, we've heard that the revenues of the city are...
It could be an enormous revenue source.
And so why
has... Nobody has even put a number on that, but it could balance the budget without reinstating this illegally collected utility tax, and it could just finance all the whoop-de-doo social programs they wanted to finance. It's a huge revenue source.
How about a heroin...
Seaside Company is one of the richest theme parks in the country. It's so, up there with Disney World.
Now, this was originally being proposed by activists like yourself and people like, perhaps like Doug Rand. I don't know if he was on board with this. I know he was fighting the Beach South of Laurel plan before he died back in 1998. And you got three new council members, Fitzmaurice, Cronin, Sugar, to join that that champion of city rights, Catherine Byers. I speak somewhat sarcastically because she seriously disappointed me. You had a city council...
I think she was the one who flaked back then also.
So there was a movement to not wait until the Seaside Company sued the city,
exactly.
but have the city go ahead and reclaim that land from the Seaside Company. What happened with that?
I think, as I understand it, Catherine didn't go along, so it went 4-3 the other way. In the process, they hired a very renowned attorney specialist in the field, Anthony Rossman, who came down and talked to the council, looked at the situation, gave a couple of public presentations that I thought were basically very encouraging of the public's position, and indicated his own willingness to proceed on the matter, but it did not happen. A shift in the council's sensibility, I suspect some strong leanings against the idea from city manager's office and city attorney's office, and I'm sure a hell of a lot of behind-the-scenes lobbying from the Seaside Company.
Let me clarify. We're talking with Phil Baer, by the way, who's a community activist, and we're talking about the Seaside Company's latest lawsuit against the city to try to assure title to, we're talking about the parking lot down there at 3rd, and what's the exact location and the extent of this property that, we're actually talking about two things. We're talking about title to everything that the Seaside Company currently occupies and more, or just what the Seaside Company currently occupies?
Well, it's all of the parking lot except for the triangle most upriver. You probably know it. It's just curious because they failed to include one parcel on the upriver end of the parking area, and it's very, in the old maps, it's always submerged, so it's very susceptible to a challenge based on
Tidelands
matter, and they didn't even include it, so that's a curious point.
So almost all the property is.
Yes.
But not any
of the parking lot.
But not any new property. Not any property they aren't currently occupying. Go ahead.
No.
Yeah.
The other thing, you know, the huge multi-million dollar item here is the land that the boardwalk itself sits on, running from the river, you know, all the way down there past the Coconut Grove. Their whole amusement park operation is also included in this thing. So it's basically playing for the entire bag of marbles from their standpoint.
Now, from your perspective, if you had, let's suppose in the ideal world, Catherine Byers had hung tough in 1998, 99, and she pressed on. I guess the city was just looking for a limited seizure of restoration of public property around the parking lot area, right?
Nobody has yet made, if the city came to its own conclusion as to what exactly would be properly and legally defined as tideland and then determined to go after it, I don't know about that. That never occurred. Everybody says at the city that some of the parking lot is tideland. Different people may have different concepts, having looked at different maps. A judge is supposed to look at all of these maps and kind of average them out.
But at least some of the parking lot was what at least a significant force at City Council in 1998 and 99 wanted to get restored to the public, and that was essentially vetoed when Catherine Byers jumped ship, so to speak, right?
Yes.
Now, you, however, were looking for a broader challenge, were you not? Because perhaps from the kind of the obverse or the converse, I'm not sure how you put it, you were taking the other side of the Seaside Company's challenge. Seaside's claiming it owns all that property. Weren't you at one point saying the Seaside owns none of that property? Or am I misrepresenting
your
position?
No, that's my opinion. Again, that's just based on looking at these old maps, though I suspect I've looked at more old maps and done more work by way of trying to overlap these old maps on the current physical landmass to determine what of the current physical landmass lies to the water side of the original landmass, which is basically the process by which a determination would be made. I've done a lot of that using various old and reputable maps close to the pertinent time, that is to say 1850. And based on that, I'm convinced that virtually the entire parking lot is tideland.
Parking lot, and
it even laps up onto 3rd Street.
What about the actual boardwalk itself?
Yes. I think it includes...
The roller coaster?
Yes. I think there may be a little strip on the inland edge that could legitimately be said to have been dry land, not subject to daily tidal submersion.
Uh-huh.
That's back in 1850. You know, that's before the railroad... before the boardwalk,
but most of
the boardwalk itself is, in my opinion, on what would be called historic tideland, should be publicly owned.
We're talking with Phil Barron. Actually, we our new and improved technology have a way to get other people on the line in case you want to call and make comments, talk to Phil, denounce him as the mad crank that he obviously is. The phone line to call.
Hey, man, it's your main beach,
hey.
Not mine.
You're
or
here.
Ours.
Indeed.
Yeah, you understand the basic concept that if it were not for the same set of laws that apply here, you would not be able to walk on the main beach because it would be privately owned?
Well, hey, it would be owned by some fine entrepreneurs instead of the vicious state agents, the communist dupes that, well, let me encourage people to call in and dispute
sometimes
this attack on our
satire.
System. 427-3772, 427-3772, if you want to talk with Phil Barron, Robert Norris here on the issue of the Tidelands, the Seaside Company's latest power grab. It's been sitting. How much money does the Seaside Company make off its parking lot every day? Do you know?
That's unknown. Practically all of their allegedly secretive board of directors, their bottom line, all of this is very difficult information to get on. Something about the way they're incorporated, they claim, allows them to keep this stuff very hush-hush. And we haven't really looked into the matter, neither has anybody else, so nobody knows. But I've seen listings of the most profitable theme parks in the nation, and they're right up there in the top 10. And that includes all these enormous things with, you know, 150 acres. It's a very profitable operation. The parking lot, you know, the 3rd Street parking lot, I think that capacity is something like 1,300 cars. $10 a car, frequently packed to the gills. So you do the math. You know, it's a sizable piece of change.
$13,000 a day?
Times 10 per day, times probably 100 days a year when it's packed.
and the costs are probably, you'd have to subtract the costs and so forth. And
pretty
interesting
minimal. How much does asphalt cost and minimum wage ticket takers?
Well, what about these substantial kickbacks? I have no knowledge of any kickbacks, but apparently there was some suggestion this original deal was not only involved in an obvious conflict of interest where Fred Swanton was both mayor and big boy of the Seaside Company, but was there any other funny business around this original deal?
Well, it's curious when the defendant files a demur, the response to the complaint, identifies a crucial problem in the complaint that would have rendered the judgment null and void, and then sometime later, before the judgment comes in, the defendant and the plaintiff agree to this waiver of facts of law, conclusions of law, and a factual basis. They basically say, well, forget this thing about the state not being involved.
Forget the Tidelands argument, in other words.
Forget the Tidelands argument, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We, A and B, City and Seaside Company, have come to this agreement. Each of us is happy with it. The judge put a stamp on it. That means that A and B can no longer squabble about the issues that are defined, you know, the who owns what. But it means absolutely nothing about whether or not it was a legal judgment, whether or not there was some other party who should have been involved and might, in fact, be the actual owner.
Let me ask you this. A lot of these arguments are based on rather arcane, ancient maps and so forth, which, you know, I mean, maybe an ordinary 21st century person looking at the situation might say, you know, for 70 years, the Seaside Company has been operating, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you squat a piece of property for 5 or 10 years, and I guess in New York City it's 5 years, maybe even in San Francisco, you get some rights. I mean, aren't you kind of dredging up ancient arguments, sort of like turning the land back to Mexico that's California, or, you know, looking...
No, this has nothing to do with Mexico. Mexico was not in any way...
You understand, you catch my drift. I mean, this is an argument about ancient precedents, which really...
Well, there are laws that are very constitutional. One of them is that nothing can be taken from the government through adverse possession. And that was the final basis for the title that was given in the 33 settlement. He said, the judge said that basically the parties had been notified and two had responded and others hadn't.
You're saying that in essence the Seaside Company swindled the city out of this land?
They think they did. It was never the city's. It was always the state. They have a title that never was legal.
But my question again is this. I mean, is there any... I mean, let's suppose that the city council had been more to our liking, because I agreed with you and hoping to see the city gain more possession here in the situation on the Tidelands. And let's suppose the city had gone after this property. What do you think would have been the outcome?
Oh, I think the public will win. I'm very optimistic that we're, you know, if I thought this was going any other way, I wouldn't bother. I think we're on the verge of the most exciting thing that's happened in this city ever.
Well, has
the entire main beach area and the estuary of the San Lorenzo River that divides the county in half and is sort of the main artery of the heart of the county, the heart being the main beach itself, was usurped by a private company in a company town kind of thing that one associates with some coal mining town in eastern Kentucky, and he got it a long time ago, and he so blinded the politicians and the general public to the fact that nobody even realizes that that is, in fact, the estuary of the San Lorenzo River, and that is, in fact, the main beach and one of the finest beaches in all of Northern California. You know, it is the natural and environmental resource of this city and county, and I think we're on the verge of getting it back into public ownership.
Has this happened anywhere else in California, that this kind of legal challenge?
Oh, yes, right, of course. The case law is crucial to this kind of a thing.
Give me some examples.
Of places where the public trust doctrine has been upheld.
Of places where tide lands has been returned to public use after having previously been held for a period of time by private property owners.
San Francisco Bay, a lot of that was privately claimed and has since been returned into public trust status. All up and down the state, you know, needless to say, a lot of people hopped in very early on in the late 19th century, early 20th, and tide land, seafront, you know, it's all a valuable property no matter what era you're talking about. And people laid claim to it, and sometimes they got away with it. Sometimes the law was, you know, you had a vigilant state lands commission in Sacramento and an administration in Sacramento that was protective, and other times it wasn't. But in terms of the case law, the way it, when you look at the judgments that have gone down in these matters.
Again, can you give me some specifics? You've mentioned San Francisco vaguely. Do you have any particular...
Long Beach, L.A., all of that.
But do you have any particular pieces of property that have some particular name that were returned, or businesses that gave up property they owned, returned it to public domain because of these kinds of challenges?
Names of properties.
Something we might, you know, I mean, more specifically, because I'm not disputing you because I haven't got any contrary knowledge, but I'm looking to get something particular that I can run with, or we can.
Well, I do believe practically the entire coastline had to be wrestled back at one time or another. So now it's all called the California coast, whereas it used to be called things like Martin's Beach and so on.
Anything else in this county? Has it been, you know, reclaimed for the public that you know of?
In this county, I'm not sure, and I really don't know what else really would fall into that category. It is tidelands, that is to say, along the beach, but also up streams and rivers as far as the tidal action affects the height of the river on a daily basis.
Right, I'm just wondering, do you have any particular instances?
It doesn't go way on up.
Yeah.
In most rivers, but there was, for example, a case in Sacramento, way the heck up there, 100 miles above the delta, where state lands won land because they determined that was subject to tidal ebb and flow even that far away from the ocean.
We're talking with Phil Baer, a local resident, activist, and all-around well-spoken curmudgeon. If you want to call in and listen, actually we can listen to you. You can talk to Phil. 427-3772 is the phone line in. The phone line is open. We actually have two lines into the studio, so jump at this chance. Maybe we can get a little more controversial, Phil. Before we go any further, though, into a new subject, first of all, you got another 5 or 10 minutes? What's your time look like?
I got 5 or 10. I'd like to wrap it up shortly.
Well, let's wrap it up. What can the community do to make sure that we, the community, get access to this property, which has been held for ransom, and we get ransom every time we park down there,
right.
You know, by the seaside company.
If we're going to be paying that kind of ransom, the money should be going to the city.
What can we do? I mean, should we contact Mike Grotkin and beg? And is he now an ally of ours or an opponent on this issue?
I'm not sure on that. That would not be a bad thing to do. I also think that the State Lands Commission is crucial in this, and the state would appreciate, even though they claim it's not all that relevant to them, I believe that they would appreciate or at least expect some sort of support from the city that would in fact be the beneficiary of this thing if it goes the right way, or environmentalists who have some idea of ever restoring the San Lorenzo to an actual river rather than a dead drainage ditch.
So what people can do is they can contact Mike Rotkin at 420-5023. And what do you want people to tell him?
That the city should vigorously defend against this Seaside Company complaint.
Okay, 420-5023. Give them a call right now. Phone lines are opened up to that
State
number.
State Lands Commission, and I don't have that address, but anybody can get it who wants it.
I actually see I'm looking at Bruce Bratton's story here. Bruce Bratton has a website, used to be in the Metro. Now he's got his own website. I think it's Bratton.org, perhaps.
Sounds right.
And he's talking about boardwalk closes beach and San Lorenzo River access.
That's a slightly separate issue, a funny little thing that they're trying to do.
Fenced off a public access route to the beach and south of San Lorenzo River.
Right.
And they're retroactively
seeking the location of that. It's rather audacious. Do you know the eastern end of the boardwalk there by the Logger's Revenge?
Vaguely.
Well,
it says it seems ped paths and bike paths are being put behind locked gates all over town. What is going on here, asks Bratton. Is this connected to the Seaside Company's lawsuit against the city regarding the tidelands at the mouth of the San Lorenzo? But the boardwalk fenced off a public access route to the beach and mouth of the San Lorenzo River. Why should this concern poor and homeless people, of which I claim to be a great champion here on the show? Why should we pay attention for you? You guys live in your homes. You're
yeah.
well-to-do, middle-class landowners fighting your battles against the Seaside Company. Why should we give a shit about this?
Do you homeless people think that you would have better access to such areas if they were privately owned?
Well, first, alarm security keeps us all safe, right?
I don't know, but... Imagine
just kidding.
If Seaside Company had private title to that, you know, would you even be allowed on the beach during the day?
Well, if
you
paid...
were wearing your tuxedo, wouldn't that beard of yours require a little trimming?
Well, I don't know about that. Let me ask you about another subject in the Metro is the seizure of Ron Lau's property downtown where the Asian Rose is. I guess art forms. It's formerly the site of the bookshop, the old bookshop Santa Cruz. Now it's a hole in the ground across between the savings bank and the Lulu Carpenters. Are any feelings about that issue yourself, Phil?
Quite distinct, and I think it's necessary to distinguish between a tidelands issue where the land is supposed to be publicly owned. And what you're talking about with Lau, which is an eminent domain taking of a private property just because somebody thinks he hasn't built in a timely manner. I mean, you may or may not agree with the taking, but that's quite a different thing than trying to regain ownership of something which by law is always supposed to have been public property and is, in fact, important to the public. You know, this city doesn't even have its own main beach. It doesn't even have its own river estuary. The city is so raped and pillaged, and it's adjusted to it in its own thinking that it doesn't even know what it's lost. It's a pathetic situation.
Huh. Well, what about the seizure of public property over in Iraq by the U.S. building 14 military bases in order to...
That, too, seems slightly non-comparable.
I am jumping a little far afield here. I know, Phil,
yes,
you have
I'm
views that...
I'm not sure you might get that indignant about the taking of public lands in your own city.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And, of course, I mean, you know, at one time or another, I really want to talk to you about some issues in which we really disagree, to wit, the drug war and the Iraqi war. But I think that, you know, your expertise on this subject in terms of the tidelands has been informative, educational, and, you know, hopefully it will spur some people to do some more research and investigation.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I realize it's a complicated, unfamiliar issue, but it's enormously important, and I hope you and your listeners will think about it.
Hey, Phil, and is there a number where if people want more information, they can talk to you or somebody else?
Yeah, call me, 423-0170.
423-0170 to talk to Phil Barry.
Right, or my wife is very knowledgeable about it.
Okay.
And we're not the only ones. We got ourselves a bit of a group. That was a very nice group of people who tried to get into that council meeting the other day.
How many
Fred
were there?
Tiger, Susan Martinez, Scott Graham, Aldo Giacchino, Reed Searley, very bright attorney, is hot on the subject. I'm hoping he'll do something by way of getting us formally involved in the legal process.
So were you originally locked out of the council meeting, or were you simply just sort of looking around for it?
Oh, no. We were told that it wasn't on the agenda, so therefore we couldn't come into the meeting. And we had to, Porter hadn't shown up yet, who had put the thing on, so we had to grab Tim Fitzmaurice, who knew about it because he and Porter had talked about it. So we had to get him and drag him out to the front of the council chamber where the thing was posted on the agenda there behind the glass window there to the side of the chamber entrance, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
So he went back in and finally said, well, guys, it really is on the agenda.
They had to let them.
In fact, I knew it because I talked about it. And, in fact, Wilson knew about it, too.
Dick Wilson?
He was just trying to keep us out. Yeah.
Wait a minute. You're not hold it. You're not suggesting our city manager was attempting to keep out this rabble?
Hey, you got to imagine the importance of this. This is big time. You know that Seaside Company has strong allies in City Hall, and that's almost an understatement.
You're not suggesting Dick Wilson is an ally of the Seaside Company,
yes,
are you?
Yes. I think if you look at the issue that Bratton is raising about that cutoff of access down there at the eastern end of the boardwalk, and you look at Wilson's recommendation to the Coastal Commission, where he basically okays it, I think you begin to see that he's ready to go along with anything that the Seaside Company proposes.
Which city council
is the attorney? I'm afraid.
Which city council members actually tried to exclude you guys from the meeting initially?
Well, we don't know because somebody just comes to the door and tells you that you can't come in. But my understanding is that they acted like they didn't know it was on the agenda. Some of them may have not known that it was on the agenda. Someone in the meeting, including Richard Wilson, should have known and should have told them.
Well, you know, the fact that
how it plays out, it was like they didn't want us there.
You know,
that was pretty obvious.
How many of you were there?
I think somebody counted 12 or 15.
You know,
they were all strong individuals representing people like the Sierra Club,
uh-huh.
And SCAN had Fred Geiger there. He, the SCAN now has a Tidelands Committee, of which he is the chair.
SCAN still exists?
Yes, I think so. I'm not very active in it these days, but do much between elections, but they're stirring for this one.
You know, regarding your right to come into the meeting, you have the right to come into that meeting without a word. They have the obligation to provide an open interval, and you don't have to say which agenda items you're there for. You announce that when they announce the open interval. So the fact that they were excluding you at the beginning sounds like an illegitimate move. Dare I say it? Would our city council make an illegitimate move? Well, perhaps it just...
I don't know. You know more about that Brown Act stuff than I. They call this a closed session meeting because it supposedly refers to pending and ongoing litigation.
They have the right to meet in private. However, you have the right to be at an open interval right before that closed session to speak on any item on the agenda, and you don't have to tell them what item it is until you're about to speak on it. Because they don't consider these items separately right after you speak.
That's a good point.
They should have let you in. Period.
I appreciate the way you push such issues. My own sense on this one is being able to speak to them doesn't mean much if, in fact, they've got their heads up their butts. But I'll try it once in a while anyway.
I agree with you. I agree with you. But I think that when you get a group of people who are representatives of significant forces in the community and they're together, then you want to make damn sure that they do have the right to speak.
Yeah, right. Well, this was an impressive gathering of people. Arana Gulch, Patricia Maticek, very knowledgeable, articulate person. Bill Malone of Citizens for Responsible Growth. You know, people with some actual clout. There's something coming together on this.
And some people
are starting to realize that something big is happening here.
And not all of you agree on a lot of issues. For example, Measure X, I'm sure that half that group are great supporters of it.
Yeah, right.
Whereas you are an opponent, right?
Uh, not outspoken. I think I'll probably vote against it just because, you know, it was an illegally gathered tax. And why do I want to give them a regressive utility tax that affects poor people proportionately much harder than it affects people of means because they're too degenerate to go for a piece of property that they should own, the proceeds from which would more than offset that utility tax. You know, let them go for the money that they is justifiably theirs rather than jacking up a tax on poor folks.
We've been talking with Phil Baer. You have any titles these days, Phil, aside from, of course, from...
No
titles?
Nope. I'm just kind of focused on this single issue.
423-0...
I do keep my mouth shut about other matters.
423-0170 if you want to talk to Phil.
Not doing a very good job of it, though.
Hey, I you know, keep it up, and maybe you'll be putting out... Do you have a website online?
No, that's something that we must get to. You know, we thought that the whole matter had been swept under the rug. We didn't know quite what to do about it. And then we found out much later, we found about it after the suit was actually filed on the 5th of July. So,
how did you find out about it?
We are usually the last to find out. You know, nobody at City Hall tells me. Apparently, according to this article, Seaside Company told the City Council that they were going to do it back in late 04, but nobody from the City Council or...
Wait a minute. What about Ed Porter and Tim Fitzmaurice, those great champions of the left?
No, you know, I think these people are coming around, but they haven't been real... you know, it's a big unfamiliar issue. It requires some sort of aggressiveness. It requires subverting the local dominant paradigm head on. You know, Seaside Company is the dominant paradigm in this city, and it's a rare individual and a rare politician who is ready to sue the bread.
Feeds
the
tax structure.
Bread, you know.
You know, 5 years ago, you were fighting the Dolphin Lee, now the Nueva Vista project, for the demolition of two kind of rather decrepit motels, but nonetheless motels that provided affordable housing for a lot of folks, and were very concerned about that essentially dispersal of a Latino population. What's the situation with the Nueva Vista down there, which I guess is a couple of blocks away from where you live, right?
Yeah, less than that, actually. Well, my understanding is that about maybe 20% of the people who live in the place were, in fact, residents in the old unit. So what we were anticipating, namely that those specific individuals were going to get the shaft, was by and large true.
What do we? Those figures are what? What are they based on? I mean, are you, did you talk?
My knowledge of who used to be around compared to who is around now.
Did you talk to Nena Ruiz?
No, I ran into her the other day.
Yeah, give her my regards when you see her.
Yeah, I rarely see her, actually.
She was head of Residentes Unidos before being hauled off to jail on heroin charges.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that happens.
Yeah, right.
We can talk.
Heroin is an enormous trauma in this neighborhood.
And we hope that you will lead the call for medicalization of that problem rather than the endless, futile police efforts which have been utterly unsuccessful nationally
to
deal with it.
You would medicalize heroin?
They do it overseas. Yeah, I would.
Yeah, well, they got some sizable heroin problems overseas.
But do they have
too.
The same crime problems? That's the question. See, I mean, you're looking at a criminal sales of heroin on the streets.
I think they treat criminal behavior much more directly and brutally than we do. Is why they don't have.
Well, are you thinking about?
You can have your heroin. We'll give it to you. You can waste your life, but if you. Pick up something in a store illegally in order to trade it for a bag of heroin, you're going to do some serious time.
Is that true in Netherlands? Because I know Netherlands and Germany and Switzerland, I guess, are the places where these are solutions are being tried. Are you?
Yeah, well, they're also being dropped. I think in a couple of those countries, and I wasn't really prepared to speak on this.
No, I'm not either.
They are turning that around. They are.
I've heard of it going both ways. I heard that there was some concern about the, you know, the upsurge in heroin use in England under heroin maintenance programs, and then I heard later that they were still doing it because they thought it was still an effective solution. So I don't know, and I can't speak on it authoritatively, but I know that you're a man who.
I'm hard nosed on the subject. I think it's a brutal drug that has to be just rigorously restricted.
Uh-huh.
Does no good.
Well, I think that, you know, my position is you need to medicalize it and get it away from the whole criminal justice system.
You're acting like these people are, you know, that's like everybody who smokes weed is a cancer patient. That's, you know.
No, it's obviously. We need to talk about these issues and when we have more time, and I really hope we can. Maybe both of us can bone up on the arguments on both sides and present a rational discussion, airing both sides of the issue.
Okay.
Maybe?
All right, Robert. Good talking to you.
Hey, Phil. Good to hear you.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Bye bye, friend.
Bye bye. And that was Phil Baer, who you can reach if you want to talk to him about the Tidelands issue. He's probably one of the more knowledgeable people in town about it. 423-0170 is his phone number. Call in here, however, if you want to talk to me, and I'm all alone here, so I need company. 427-3772. Give me a call if you'd like. Hi there. You're on Free Radio.
Hello, Bathrobes Pierre?
Yes, sir.
Is this live?
You are live. Do you want to be live?
Yes, that's fine. I thought that was great, and he's so knowledgeable about that issue, Mr. Baer.
Uh-huh.
And the only place I would differ was in a very friendly differing, in the sense it's not that hard to understand. No elected official should be frightened of such an issue as if it's too complex for them to understand. And I do think this is where legal, it's cool that he knows all those strange names of things that have been concocted. This is definitely where law is leading us astray, because it's, or the complexity of law. It seems pretty simple. The Tidelands are like a measurable area. The land down there that is being occupied, regardless of the fill or alteration that's happened to raise it or do whatever the fuck to it over time, that has nothing to do with the law. It's owned by the state of California, and then it's somehow leased. He said some other type of word, that it's leased to the city, and the proceeds go to the city. It's that simple. And that 1933 document is all concocted, and it totally does not trump the Tidelands law. There you go. It's really easy. It's easy to understand. Nobody should be scared of it. There's nothing to it. Let's just get it done.
Hey, call Mike Rotkin at 420-5023 and tell him to get his shit together and fight this case. They should have been fighting it 6 years ago, and they weren't. So
I completely agree. I really agree. And I think it was made really clear by the segment that you just did, and people should get busy. I mean, whatever we can do to make that happen. And I think it was really good to link it to the current budget deficit, where all kinds of things other than the police department and the fire department, and obviously we need some funds for the fire department there and some for the police, I suppose, but yeah, just the way there's this huge deficit, and this is obviously a place, rather than cutting needed programs for the poor and various other things that we really need, like street lights. So these are the things that they're saying they're going to cut. What the fuck, man? It's fucking bullshit.
Well, they want to charge you more money under the threat of eliminating social services instead of going to the rich cats, who should be, you know, I mean, some people have been made money hand over fist from that parking lot. Why aren't they being held to account? You know, I guess the real person to call is not Mike Rotkin, it's Dick Wilson, the city manager, because he's the man, the real power chief in this city.
Ah, the Wilsons, I know, powerful family, goes way back. And hey, I'm just going to say one last thing and then open up lines for others. One addendum to the Seaside Company deal, they charged, I was in a haunted house that for 3 years we did, the Labyrinth Haunted House was at other locations, but for 3 years we were down in part of that huge parking lot that you have been keep referring to. And they charged us $10,000 to be there for a month. And it really made it impossible for the person, the proprietor, writer who's doing it for all the right reasons, totally not just to make money, just to be able to sustain this thing. You know, we weren't able to do this creative project that everybody really loved, that this really good friend put out a lot of money to allow us to do this project, and we were paid, and it was totally cool. And to me, it's just that they have control of that, and this inordinate amount of money was charged. They didn't even have anything to do with it. They really weren't gaining us anything other than 50 cars could not park in that spot. So that's my only direct interaction with the CSED company, and it definitely left a bitter taste because it was like the main reason why it was really impossible to get over the hump of even making the money back. You know, as so many creative projects are like that, and I see it, it's because these uncreative capitalist fuckers are usually in control of a lot of these things, and in my experience, it fucks shit up for everybody. I would love that area to not be in control of that company.
Hey, amen. Thanks.
Thank you for your show, Robert.
Hey, thanks for calling and giving us that bit of information.
Yeah, you got it, man.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
Phone line's open, 427-3772, talking about the Seaside Company's latest sneak lawsuit, stealth lawsuit that zipped into council. And apparently council wanted to close the doors on the people who were most articulate and most concerned about bringing the issue to the city council in closed session. But they weren't able to, even though they tried. If you want to call in and talk about it, 427-3772.
A small thing once happened at school that brought home a question for me. Somehow it taught me to see the price that I pay to be cool. Diane is this girl that I know. She's strange, like she doesn't belong. I don't mean to say that that's wrong. We don't like to be with her, though. So when we all made a plan to have this big party at Sue's, most kids at our school got the news, but no one invited Diane. Well, the thing about Taft Junior High is secrets don't last very long. I acted like nothing was wrong when I saw Diane start to cry. I know you may think that that's cruel. It doesn't make me very proud. I just went along with the crowd. It's sad, but you have to at school. You can't pick the friends you prefer. Fit in as well as you can. I couldn't be friends with Diane, 'cause then they might treat me like her. In one class at Taft Junior High, we study what people have done with gas chamber bomber and gun in Auschwitz, Japan, and me lie. I don't understand all I learn. Sometimes I could sit there and cry. The whole world stood idly by to watch as the innocent burned. Like robots obeying some rule, atrocities done by the mob. All innocents doing their job. What was that for? Was it cool? The world was aware of this hell, yet how many cried out in shame? What heroes and who was to blame? The story that no one dared tell. Promise to do what I can to not let it happen.
start by inviting Diane.
And that was Courage from Ann Feeney's album, Have You Been to Jail for Justice? Well, I went to the court for justice yesterday. I'm being charged with disrupting a public meeting and resisting arrest, and I faced 2 years in jail and a $2,000 fine, and I appeared as my own attorney. That's I had a fool for a client, as they say, and I've got to get 2 week continuance. So I'm still looking for legal help out there, everybody. So all you attorneys, line up and give me a call at 423-HUFF. 423-4833. I'm going to take this call briefly, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Hiroshima. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Robert.
Hey, this must
How
be...
How are you?
I'm good. This sounds like Bob to me.
It certainly is, Robert. Hi.
Have you lost all your friends over there at De Anza?
I don't think so, but I don't monitor those things that closely.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about someone that you and I both know,
sure.
Becky Johnson. I've known Becky for 10 years. I'm not saying I agree with her tactically or strategically or anything.
She is my producer and a proud member of HUFF.
But some of these charges that have been lobbied against her very publicly, okay, on free radio, and the like, they boiled down to two key charges, that she's a racist. If this is what we think, agree with us, or you're out of here.
Well, there is a dispute as to the interpretation of a particular aid to a man called Lee Kaplan who conveyed it to the Daily Media, which I think violates their own policies, frankly, their own policies of misconduct, her work for legal help out there, everybody. So all you attorneys, line up and give me a call at 423-HUFF. 423-4833. I'm going to take this call briefly, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Hiroshima. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Robert.
Hey, this must
How
be...
How are you?
I'm good. This sounds like Bob to me.
It certainly is, Robert. Hi.
Have you lost all your friends over there at De Anza?
I don't think so, but I don't monitor those things that closely.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about someone that you and I both know,
sure.
Becky Johnson. I've known Becky for 10 years. I'm not saying I agree with her tactically or strategically or anything.
She is my producer and a proud member of HUFF.
But some of these charges that have been lobbied against her very publicly, okay, on free radio, and the like, they boiled down to two key charges, that she's a racist. If this is what we think, agree with us, or you're out of here.
Well, there is a dispute as to the interpretation of a particular aid to a man called Lee Kaplan who conveyed it to the Daily Media, which I think violates their own policies, frankly, their own policies of misconduct. Her work, most of my listeners are probably going to agree with this, so I'm probably preaching to the choir. But I ran across an interesting article. Was if you've heard this, but I think it's bears reach. Japanese were almost defeated and ready to surrender. Alperowitz, something painful for Americans to consider. It is true that by the end of World War II, the lines between waging war and sympathies. He believed one of the few provisions and to transmit the complete. Historians now tend to believe that there was another explanation, which was and had already begun the process of seeking the terms of surrender. The second bomb was that the Japanese home islands was needed. Our crime by the nation which committed aggression? Was it not a crime to use the nuclear bomb without exploring the Japanese peace feelers? Anyone still believes the use of nuclear bombs was necessary? I'm about to read you Hiroshima and the Bundy Lies. That was called Was Hiroshima Necessary to End the War? A little boy raises his hand to his forehead to shield his eyes from the sun. His shadow seems to show he was saluting an invisible captain. A toddler laughs with pleasure. Shadow seems to show that he is whole. Will promote war, will use any excuse to attempt to just a few short weeks after the end of this latest war. History convinces us that they were right and we were wrong to oppose them. A feature article in Wednesday's Melbourne Age caught my eye, written by Christoph, described as a Pulitzer Prize winner in Japan, was right, being part of the Black Armband Brigade or members of dissident communities fighting lost battles, and Christoph doesn't let us down. He accuses those of us who attempt to understand our society by what it does or did, rather than what it said it would do or did. Christoph argues that although there is persuasive evidence supporting the moral argument against the U.S. dropping the only atomic weapons used in war so far, there is a far greater argument. and it talks about the myth circle to get peace declared. And I want to thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Come back again, and if you want to review...
Looking at you, girl, yeah, you took him for a ride. You fixed that bitch, didn't you? It's all the maximum sentence the law will allow. Oh, tell me, who the bitch now? You found you a queer, promised him some head. You drove him out, tied him up, beat him down, and left him what you said. You didn't see it was wrong. You were only seeing red. Now you'll see pinstripes round your ankles every night. You'll get used to it, boys. The irony is plain to see if you know the definition. In this position, and thought you'd hide your vice behind that big blue wall of I wouldn't take a bow. Tell me, who the bitch now?